From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Nine devices containing explosives have been intercepted on their way to Democratic politicians, CNN's New York City studios, and liberal cause financial supporter George Soros. Fortunately, none of the devices detonated. No one's been hurt. And the FBI is conducting forensics examination of the devices and attempting to find the person or persons who sent them. We'll have the latest after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We have a program that is chock full of election information. We have a couple of candidates who will be joining us a little bit later, the Attorney General Javier Becerra, the Democratic incumbent, and we'll also have the Republican challenger for Secretary of State, Mark Moiser, will be with us in studio. And we also have a statewide ballot measure to debate as well. So a lot of important information to hopefully help you prepare as you're going to vote on November 6th or voting earlier by mail. But first, FBI investigators are trying to determine who sent nine similar explosive devices to Democratic politicians, CNN's New York studios, and billionaire supporter of liberal causes George Soros. There was even a package that arrived here in Los Angeles at the South LA mail facility, reportedly addressed to Congresswoman Maxine Waters, which the LAPD, after rendering it apparently harmless, turned the device over to the FBI for further investigation. With us to share the very latest developments, including the two devices that were found this morning, is Zolan Cano Youngs, who is New York-based law enforcement reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Zolan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So share with us what all of these devices appear to have in common.
Yeah, absolutely. So all the way, I mean, starting with Soros to Hillary Clinton, to the package that arrived at Hillary Clinton's home, and even this morning with the package that arrived to Mr. De Niro's property in Lower Manhattan, and of course the packages that were intercepted in Delaware that were addressed to former Vice President Joe Biden. What law enforcement is looking for in these suspicious packages are, unfortunately, and very scary, there are large manila envelopes, you know, normal packages that you might find. They have on the top right corner two rows of stamps. And the similarity that we found, we have not confirmed this for the two packages sent to Biden, but it is the case for De Niro and all the other packages sent to other prominent Democrats, that they list Debbie Wasserman Schultz as the sender. They misspell her name. And then I actually had a couple sources tell me they're, quote, extremely similar, quote, identical, with the exception of the recipient, that being, you know, that it went to the recipient was listed for CNN as John Brennan, and then this morning the recipient was listed as Robert De Niro. Police are also telling businesses as well as media organizations and the public, really, to be on the lookout for packages that misspell any names, have protruding wires, excessive or missing postage stamps, mail from an unknown origin, no return address. All of those things, which are, you know, can be pretty broad, is what the police are looking for now.
Now, we've heard that some of the packages, I believe the one to CNN at its Time Warner Center location, was delivered by hand. Some of the others, as you indicated, went through U.S. Postal Service facilities. Do we have any idea at this point as to why some would have been hand-delivered and others mailed?
You know, I haven't – what I've heard from my sources is that it's not clear yet on whether the CNN package was actually delivered.
Ah, okay, because I thought that they had reported there was no postage on it and that they had assumed it was hand-delivered. So that's it. So they may have all gone through the mail.
They may have all gone through the mail. What I heard most recently from a source is that most, if not all, of these packages went through the mailing system. And I have read reports that the CNN package was delivered by a courier, but also a courier can be, you know, it can mean a couple different things. Does that mean it's FedEx? Does that mean a messenger? I'm not clear yet on that.
Okay, so all of these are being looked at. Is there a central location where all the devices, to your knowledge, are being delivered, Zolan?
Where they're being delivered? I mean, we've had it. There's been a range. You
know? No, I mean for. Delivered post receiving where they're going to be taken apart and looked at.
Oh yes, of course, sir. So I can take you through the whole path.
Great.
Packages. So if one, for example, the packages that have been found in the New York area, those, you know, for the one that was sent to Time Warner Center, CNN, as well as De Niro, NYPD bomb squad is going to respond. They're then going to transfer that package into a total containment vessel, a bomb truck. They put that that device into a white sphere on the back of the truck. If that device is to go off, it's going to be contained. That truck then takes these packages to Rodman's Neck in the Bronx, where the NYPD has a facility where they can analyze these devices. But at this point, this thing is being handled by NYPD as well as FBI, as the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The goal is to get all of these devices to one central location at the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia. Once they're there, the FBI is going to be analyzing these things, and this is a central and crucial point of the investigation. Right now, they want all of those things in one place, so they can analyze how they were built, what objects were used, and look at any kind of similarities to try and hone in on a suspect.
We're talking with the Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Kano-Youngs joining us. He's been following this story very, very closely. Is there any thought from the sources you've talked with about why none of these have fortunately detonated? Is it clear that they were truly designed to go off at some point?
More questions than answers at this point. I mean, you know, it's you're right. It's come up. You know, were these things just sent out to intimidate? Were they actually intended to go off? Was there something needed in order for them to detonate? That we don't know at this point. What I have heard from multiple federal sources at this point is that they were homemade. Likely made by an amateur. That they were potentially effective as well, and that they were legitimate. You might have seen that Mayor Blasio went on air yesterday on CNN and said that these were live explosive devices and they could have caused real harm. You know, and then just today, Governor Andrew Cuomo went on air and said that he heard that they might have just been sent out to intimidate. So it's unclear at this point.
All right. Zolan, thank you so much. Really appreciate your bringing us up to date on all the devices. And, of course, we've heard the warnings from law enforcement officials that these may not be all of the devices. There may be others to be found in the future as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Zolan Kano-Youngs of the Wall Street Journal, also with us from Eastern Kentucky University, Professor Tom Thurman. He teaches explosion investigation as well as fire and arson investigation. He's a former Army bomb disposal technician and supervisory special agent with the FBI. He was there for two decades doing forensic examination of explosive devices on a number of very high-profile threats. Professor Thurman, thank you for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, Larry, with you and your listeners.
Thanks. Well, let's start. These devices, once they arrive at the FBI's Quantico, Virginia facility, what are the investigators going to specifically look at?
Well, they're going to look at the totality of all the devices. They will be examined to ensure that if they are in fact explosive devices, that they have been properly rendered safe so they will not explode in the laboratory, a safety mechanism everyone can understand. Then the devices, each one of them will be examined in total as a separate device. After that is done, then there will be an intercomparison examination through all of these devices to determine that if there is a single bomber signature involved with these devices. And, I mean, it would certainly appear at this point from some of the photographs, I think, that we've all seen and the media reporting, that it's pretty self-evident at this point that it is from a single person or persons, and it's not a copycat. Just looking at the outside of the envelopes, the number of stamps, the type of envelopes that are all appear to be identical with each other. I mean, that tells you something at the very, very beginning, if you will. Then the examinations will get extremely detailed with these devices. Biometrics, and what we mean by biometrics is looking for any traces of DNA from the builder, as well as latent fingerprints. And the capabilities of the FBI is just remarkable in today's world with DNA. And that would be a great thing for us to have that indication at this point that there's identifiable DNA that might be able to be intercompared with somebody out there to identify the person who put these together very early.
I'm going to ask you just to make an educated guess if you feel comfortable. Do you think there's a high degree of likelihood that this individual is someone who previously or individuals previously come on to law enforcement radar, or do you have many cases where someone is unknown and just comes out of the blue with something like this?
Larry, it is really difficult to make that conclusion, certainly at this point, or even conjecture. It's possible in both realms that this is someone as a lone wolf that we've seen in other terrorist incidents, not only here but around the world, comes out never seen, never known before. And it's also possible that that someone has been involved with the law enforcement agencies in the past and has decided to come back onto the scene. I've seen instances of both cases.
Yes. All right. We're talking with Eastern Kentucky University Professor Tom Thurman. He's an authority on investigations into explosive devices, fire, and arson. He teaches it at Eastern Kentucky, but he spent 20 years at the FBI as a supervisory special agent working on the forensics of explosive devices, and he was an Army bomb disposal technician as well. We're finding out from him how the FBI is likely to conduct its investigation. What will the type of explosive substance tell the investigators?
Well, that would be one of the avenues of investigation that they would have early on and look at it as whether it is a low explosive such as smokeless powder, what we refer to as gunpowder, or a high explosive. And with that determined, start looking for sources of those types of explosives, absolutely. And then how those explosives were meant to explode within these what reported to be pipe bombs. And so there's actually, Larry, what we're looking at here is a two-pronged investigation. And as your previous guy from the Wall Street Journal was saying, that there's a lot of field investigation by people on the scene trying to determine how these devices got to where they are. In other words, was it in fact through the mail system, or were there some delivery people involved? So that's the first aspect. And then if it came through the mail, okay, well, where did it come through the mail? Where were they put into the distribution system for the Postal Service? At the same time, down at the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia, as they're going through these devices, as they're trying to pull out evidence, whether it directly implicates an individual or individuals, as I said, with fingerprints or DNA, or we're looking at looking at the specific components that are used, that information will then go back to the investigators and say, hey, we've got this, if you will, widget in the device, and they're the same in all 8-10 devices. Where could an individual gotten purchased this many of these particular components? So they start running, literally, leads. It could be all over the country of finding out where these items came from. So it is a very detailed, problematic investigation that is from many, many viewpoints where, again, it's forensically driven, if you will, at this point out of Quantico and the laboratory, that they come up with these, okay, this is what this is. They send it to the investigators, and the investigators start running it with leads. And that's how that you identify the person or persons that have constructed these devices.
And you'd think if the individual or individuals were mailing them out of the same facility, that would have raised red flags. So you'd think, well, multiple places, yet they arrive within a similar time frame. So it wouldn't necessarily be like the person's traveling around the country, mailing them, you know, from far distant places. So many different things to check on this. I did want to ask you, though, briefly about the igniter, because if it's a device that's a timing device, that wouldn't enable a bomber to control that it detonates, you know, at an intended target. And if it is remotely generated, you'd think there'd have to be some proximity with the arrival of the package, right? You have to have someone close. So I'm just curious, as a practical matter, how this would be expected to work.
Okay, and you're right on the money with that as a practical matter. Partial bombs or mail bombs don't normally have any type of a timing mechanism for that reason. They're designed to explode when an unwitting victim opens them up.
So there's a trigger, some sort of motion trigger or pressure trigger when someone opens the box or envelope.
Not motion, but it, exactly your second.
Pressure trigger.
A pressure release, a pull release or something like that within the package or within the bomb itself. Certainly, I would imagine the aspect of just opening the package would be meant to trigger the device, because certainly you open it and you see what's in it, and then you're going to run. So it would be in the very early stages. Now, a timer could be used to what we call arm the system, to make the system have the capability to explode when it's opened.
So you wouldn't have an accidental detonation.
Exactly.
Earlier, yeah.
In the whole methodology here, in most cases, and we don't know what's in the mind of the beholder. No, we don't. But in most cases, these are not meant to explode in the mail system, because they're not to their destination. They're meant to explode at their destination. Now, none of these have exploded, thankfully. No one has been injured, and because of that, as we said, there is a myriad of forensic evidence there that the investigators will be poring over.
Professor, thank you so much for spending your time with us. We really appreciate it.
Larry, it is my pleasure.
Thank you. From Eastern Kentucky University, Professor Tom Thurman, extensive experience both at the FBI working on high-profile investigations such as the 84 Lockerbie bombing, the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, the Lebanon embassy bombing, 83 and 84, then to the FBI for two decades, and now teaching those learning about this area of expertise at Eastern Kentucky. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPEC. Coming up, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State in California, back in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you've been listening for any time, you know that we're bringing you all the candidates possible, as well as the ballot measure, to help prepare you to cast your vote November 6th or early with your mail-in ballot. And in case you've missed any of those debates on ballot measures or candidates' interviews, you can find all of them in our voter game plan at elections.laist.com. You can read up on all the candidates and ballot measures. Also, we're here to help you with our voter cram session, which will be airing coming up this Sunday right here on 89.3 KPCC. In case you missed it the first time around, pick up your sample ballot, sit down, listen to the radio. That's coming up this Sunday. I'm joined right now by Republican candidate for California Secretary of State, Mark Moisier. He is challenging the current Secretary of State, Alex Padilla, who will be joining us at a future date. Mr. Moisier, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what made you decide to run for this office? What attracts you to the position of Secretary of State?
Well, I'll be honest. They asked for volunteers, and I was the only one who wasn't smart enough to take two steps back.
Where was this at the state Democratic or Republican meeting? Or
no,
where?
I'm actually an election law attorney, and some election law attorneys came up to me and said, "Mark, we need you to run for Secretary of State. The state of California has the third worst elections in the United States of America, according to MIT." And they also pointed out that Harvard has recently done a study of the United States of America and found that of the 28 Western democracies, United States of America is ranked 28th when it comes to election integrity. And they just kept on showing me, some of the many problems that we have, many that I knew because I was an election law attorney. But, the stat, we have 23,108 people on the voter rolls who are older than the oldest person living in the state of California.
And they're still voting. Isn't that wonderful?
16,780 of them voted in the presidential election of 2016.
Do we know who they voted for?
We do not know. But,
Kennedy or Nixon?
The 16,000 people change in the presidential election between Trump or in Hillary? No, but it can actually have a very large impact on a city council race or county supervisor, maybe even a very close assembly race. And so the integrity of our elections are important. And I have been running on the platform that we need to restore integrity in our election system. And too often the Secretary of State is a professional politician who's been term limited out, just uses it as a stepping stone for some other office. And this group of election law attorneys said it's time – California's elections are such a shambles. We have so many problems going on. We need somebody who actually understands election law, someone who's actually been in the rooms when they've been counting the votes, understands how the law and procedures interact with each other, someone who's actually been involved in presidential level recounts, someone who's studies this issue, understands the issue.
Let's talk a little bit about that background. Now, you're part of Harmeet Dhillon's law firm, is that right?
That is correct.
Who's been a leading Republican here in California, been on our program a number of times. So with that firm, is that where you've done the election law cases?
I have done it with the firm and outside the firm. I just joined her firm about a year and a half ago, but I was, I've been involved in election law for about the last 6 years.
And have these been challenges of where recounts have been? What sorts of cases have you handled?
Oh, election law is pretty broad when you start thinking about it. It's, the ballot title that somebody gets designated, ballot title challenges, whether in city of San Francisco, you can get public funding for your race if you raise certain levels. So I've dealt with litigation on that. I have been, represented county parties where I've been in the room watching the counting of the vote to make sure all the procedures are followed. I've, of course, was in Wisconsin and Michigan during the presidential level recounts, sitting there, advising. Helping the county officials saying, okay, how do we get the honest vote? How do we make sure that every legal vote cast was properly counted?
So how would, if you were elected Secretary of State, how would you bring that expertise to the office? Let's take the example of more than 23,000 people, presumably dead, who are still registered to vote. How would you deal with making the rolls more accurate?
Okay, let's start with this. There, you have the voter registration rolls. It's the duty and the responsibility of the Secretary of State to maintain those rolls. That's federal law. Supreme Court has reiterated that, and state law. So it's pretty clear that that is the duty of the Secretary of State. Earlier this year, there was a Supreme Court brief filed by the state of California in which they identified 11 different government databases that a Secretary of State can use to clean up the voting rolls. Yet the state of California is only using 3 of those databases. Thus, we know as a state 8 different databases that we have access to, and we're simply not doing it. And the most glaring problem is Social Security death records. We are not comparing our voter rolls with the Social Security death records. It is a half a page form. half a page form that I have to fill out, give to United States Social Security, and they'll send us on a monthly basis the death records, and you can compare it with our voter rolls, and you remove the people who have passed away. Another database that is identified in there is the tax assessment records. If we did that, we would know that there are 12 people registered to vote at a miniature golf course in San Diego, or 31 people registered to vote at a check cashing store in Gardenia, or my favorite is the 23 people registered to vote at a hotel that has been closed for 2 years in Costa Mesa.
That's pretty spooky. But there are those who would say, so what? If you've got people that don't exist or are dead that are registered to vote, the likelihood that that's going to be – that those registrations will be used for nefarious purposes are slight. What's your response to that?
Well, 75 people registered to vote at a non-existent lot in Malibu, 15 of which voted in June of this year. Now, we know from time to time there are very close races that come down to a razor's thin margin. You know, Bernie Sanders, his very first race as mayor, he won by 10 votes. Way back, I think that was like 1980 or something like that. Every vote does matter, and it really matters down at the lower level. And that's where they think, you know, two votes here in this precinct or two votes here in this precinct. That's where, you know, this can be a problem where it really takes away the voice of the people. And since we live in a constitutional republic where we the people have the right – the duty and the responsibility to elect our representatives who represent us, not special interests, they represent us. It is critical that we have a fair and honest system where every legal vote cast is properly counted and we do not give power to those who want to commit fraud.
We're talking with Mark Moisier. He is an election law attorney, Republican candidate for California Secretary of State. The incumbent Democrat Alex Padilla will be joining us at a future time. If you have questions for Mr. Moisier, you can post them on our Air Talk page, kpcc.org, or you can call and pass them through our call screeners at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. As you're well aware, there are many concerns about the integrity of voting systems here in California. We don't use electronic voting systems. It's paper. Do you think that we have a secure enough system for actually casting and counting votes, or would you attempt to bring changes to the process?
That's a very good question. As I talk to security experts, what they uniformly tell me is that California and most register of voters across this country do not use the highest level of security, of highest level of encryption. They are not using the level of encryption that we use to guard our money, that banks use to guard our money, or doctors use to guard our healthcare records. We are cheap. And as long as we are being cheap with the level of encryption that we are using on our voter databases, we will never be at the place where we can move to the technology of where you can have internet voting. So as long as government is going to be stingy and just do the minimum level of encryption, no, we cannot even consider going that way. You have to be treated like a bank where our vote is probably more important than our money. Most people don't think of it that way, but our vote is precious. It is important, and it's sad that, you know, our government does not always put the security level into the protecting that vote.
So where would that encryption need to be? So you've got at polling locations, ballots that are collected in Los Angeles County, for example, they're taken to a central location physically to have them voted. Is it after that point that you see the vulnerability?
Well, you know, in our current system, your question was a future. Now you're talking about the present. And
well, I'm talking about if you see any current vulnerabilities. I know online voting creates a whole host of very complex issues. But in terms of how California currently has, do you think there are any vulnerabilities now?
Yes, there are. I mean, I had people who were in L.A. County register of voters office walking down the hallway, and there were just boxes upon boxes of ballots that anybody could have reached in and grabbed it, stuffed in their pocket, and walked out, that they weren't being guarded and protected even inside the voter, you know, Dean Logan's office. It's, you know, we got problems with the whole entire process. Yes, it's paper so that there's an audible trail, but, you know, many states, you actually count the ballots at the precinct And before the people who were watching the votes all day, before they leave and go home, they've already counted those ballots. And so you have a number before it gets to the central check place. But, you know, one of the bigger problems is we don't do enough audits of our elections, and we don't do enough outside audits of our elections. If you remember 2000, Bush v. Gore, you know, every available attorney in the nation was in the state of Florida examining the recount, and we saw a lot of problems, and the Florida legislature actually had to go make some changes. That, in a way, it acted as a outside audit. 2016, when I did Michigan and Wisconsin, there were tons of attorneys that were on those states watching the process. And, you know, Michigan had to pass some laws to make some changes to their voting system. Right now in the state of California, the current Secretary of State is shunning both sides of the aisles from having any kind of outside examination of whether California is following its own election law, whether it's Donald Trump on the right wanting to, you know, examine the California elections, or some Bernie Sanders supporters down in San Diego who looked at the fact and they said, wait a second, Bernie Sanders won 3 out of 4 different methods of voting, but only lost in the mail-in ballots. We need to look at that. But that they were stopped from being able to look at that.
So you'd support on a regular basis auditing of elections where what? Independent third-party examiners would come in, look at the process? What?
The Secretary of State has independent investigation duties. But I think that because California has the third worst elections, we really need to focus on bringing some integrity back to our elections. And I think that the only way that that happens is if we actually open it up and allow some outside groups to come in and give us the blue ribbon seal of approval.
I need to wrap up our conversation. We want to give you a chance to make a final statement as to why voters should support your candidacy, Mr. Moisher.
My name is Mark Moisher. I'm running to be your next Secretary of State. I am an election law attorney, as you heard, and I'm here to restore integrity to our elections. The counting of your ballot is not a partisan issue. We need integrity in our election process so that everyone is ensured that their vote actually counts. There's about 70% of people out there does not believe that their vote matters. And I'm here running for Secretary of State because I believe your vote does matter. And I want everybody on November 6th to please get out and vote. Yesterday, we were named the number one grassroots support campaign in the state. And so I'm going to encourage you to go to my website, markmoisher.com, markmuser.com, and join the team.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moisher. We appreciate your being with us. Once again, Democratic incumbent Alex Padilla, current Secretary of State, will be joining us sometime in the future, and we'll be talking with him as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, it's the Triple Play. We do our analysis of the Dodgers falling 2 straight games, Fenway Park in Boston. What's going wrong with the Dodgers? We'll talk about that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Coming up later on Air Talk, State Attorney General Javier Becerra, who's running for re-election. He's going to be with us. That's coming up in our next hour right here on KPCC. But first, it's the Dodgers down 2-0 in their best-of-7 World Series against the Boston Red Sox. The Dodgers, with dreadful offensive output last night, just 3 hits, and found themselves losing yet again to the Red Sox. Game 3 will be here in Los Angeles tomorrow night at Dodger Stadium, continue through the weekend. And should the Dodgers survive past Sunday, it returns to Fenway in Boston on Tuesday. Joining me, the Triple Play, Nick Roman of All Things Considered, A. Martinez of Take Two. Let me start with you on this, A, and your thoughts on what's going on with the offense.
Yeah, 20 strikeouts in 2 World Series games. They have 11 hits, 6 walks.
20? That's low.
I know. And someone might say, well, what's the big deal? It's an out, right? Who cares how you make an out? The point is, when you strike out, you leave no room for anything else to happen. Either you get a home run or you walk back to the dugout. At least if you make contact, something might happen.
An error, perhaps.
An error, anything where the play keeps going, and the Dodgers right now are going back to that thing that I've lamented over the years, is that, that all they do is either go for it all or sit back down.
And also their devotion to platooning, you know, playing players based on the handedness of the pitcher, meant that their top home run hitters in yesterday's game just sat on the bench till late in the game.
Yeah, you have about 90 home runs sitting on the bench when a left-hand pitcher is pitching for the other team. And I was telling A that of the six losses that the Dodgers have in postseason, there's seven wins and six losses right now. Five of those six losses were started by a left-hander, which means Cody Bellinger sits down, Jock Peterson sits down, a lot of times Max Muncy sits down, and that's a ton of home runs on the bench. And in return, what you get is you get a lot of Kike Hernandez, you get Brian Dozier, and you now we're getting Austin Barnes. Kike and Austin Barnes are hitting under 100 in the postseason. Dozier and Grandal, Dozier at 133, Grandal at 125. That's your right-handed lineup there when a lefty's going. And so where most teams get three outs in an inning, essentially the Dodgers get two, because one of those guys is going to make an out and stop everything that's going on.
I don't have a problem, though, with Austin Barnes, because he's just replacing a catcher who's been slumping for weeks now in Grandal. It's the others that I have a problem with, because, you know, especially with Kike Hernandez, who when he's hot is extraordinary. Yeah. But he's a streaky hitter, and it seems like in the Dodgers' statistical analysis, there's just no consideration of when a player is slumping or hot.
That's the problem, because that is based on large sample sizes, the season, the 162 games. But in the last possible seven games of a season, which is the World Series, don't you have to put your best foot forward, whether it's a left-handed hitter against a left-handed pitcher? Who cares? If that's your best position player available, use them. What are you waiting for?
Well, and we saw this with pitching in the first game.
Oh, that's enough.
on Wednesday night, when Dave Roberts takes out Pedro Baez, who's humming along. I don't know the last time he'd given up a hit to a left-handed hitter. I mean, it's been weeks.
A long time.
weeks, I think. And
listen,
and
he's a Baez lover now.
I know. He's a big fan.
I love Pedro Baez. the guy who used to give me cold sweats when he come into the game. But he's hot. And so again, he's hot. And instead, they bring in Alex Wood, who has looked lost on the mound since he was sent to the bullpen. I don't know whether he's upset that he was taken out of the rotation, but he hasn't looked right on the mound. And nonetheless, Roberts brings him in the game, and we, of course, know what happened with the home run that followed.
Well, I will, in Alex Wood's defense, and I'm not going to go real far down this road, that pitch was low and in. It was not. It was the kind of pitch that you don't expect anyone to hit, and it got hit, and it went out.
That's a fair defense.
But I will say this. The choice that the Dodgers were making in that particular situation in Game 1 was, do you want Pedro Baez to throw against Devers, the third baseman left-hand hitter for the Red Sox, or do you want Alex Wood pitching against Eduardo Nunez, who is not known as a home run hitter and has played around in the American League and the National League? They faced him a lot when he's with the Giants. I'm with you. I would have biased.
The hot hand.
He smoked a whole bunch of guys, and Alex Wood came in and couldn't take care of that situation. And the Dodgers now, three times in this World Series, a pitcher has come in with runners on base and two outs, and that first batter has messed up everything. Madsen has walked the first batter twice.
Walked the run in.
And Wood gave up that home run. You know, it's sort of like that old thing, you had one job, and they didn't get it done.
Do you guys remember the sitcom The Office? Michael Scott is the manager of Dunder Mifflin, and he takes things very literally. So there was a scene there where the GPS is telling them that he has to drive into the lake. And even though Dwight is telling him, that's a lake, he goes, no, the GPS is telling me I have to drive in the lake. He drives in the lake. That's the Dodgers right now, in that whatever these statistics say to do, they will do, even if in the moment common sense and the eyeball test tells you otherwise.
Yeah, and it, as we've talked about before, this seems to be an over-reliance on large sample size, which in certain applications, of course, makes sense. but defies the nature of baseball as you know, much more temporal, that a lot of the analysis needs to be within a short period of time. And their ability to balance that seems very, very limited. Now, I know these guys, these are Ivy League guys.
They're
in
smart
the front
dudes.
They're
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah.
They're brilliant guys. I don't quite understand how they missed that part of it.
Well, I think some of this is fixable. The stuff with the pitchers, for example, is fixable. You can make decisions about who you bring in and who you don't. The stuff with the batters, I'm not sure that that's fixable because these guys are what they are. There's no guarantee that if you have Jock Peterson or Cody Bellinger, swinging against a lefty, that they're going to do any better than guys that are right-handed and are not hitting right now. So the Dodgers are in a bit of a quandary. The quandary does not show up tomorrow because the Red Sox are pitching a right-hander, and so all the lefties will be in there, and if they all hit home runs and the Dodgers win, we're all happy as can be, you know?
But it seems to me the Dodgers need to sweep the three at home. I think if they lose even one of them, the task of having to go into Fenway and win two games, that's a huge challenge. Let's hold out. I want to hear what you two think about it. Do the Dodgers realistically need to sweep the three at home over this weekend to really have a chance to win this series? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We're talking Dodgers with the triple play. A. Martinez, Nick Roman, me, Larry Mantle. We'll be back in 1 minute. I was just saying to Nick Roman that I always thought of platooning players, in other words, stacking your lineup with left-handers against right-handed pitchers and vice versa. That's something you do on a marginally talented team to try and get the most out of hitters whose splits against right and left-handers are particularly dramatic. But, Nick, you reminded of previous years.
Well, Casey Stengel used to do all kinds of platooning, but the guys that he was platooning
in the Hall
New
of
York
Fame
Yankees,
now.
And they're really, really good.
Yeah, it's a little different under those circumstances. So I said I think the Dodgers really need to sweep at home games 3, 4, and 5 to have a legitimate, you know, chance. What do you think, A?
Can I bring up a scenario to both of you?
Yeah,
it
sure.
could be a
yeah.
possible nightmare scenario, but let me bring this up and see what you guys would say. So under normal amount of rest, Clayton Kershaw would be scheduled to pitch game 5 on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say the Dodgers and Red Sox split the next two games. So the Red Sox can clinch on Sunday. Kershaw scheduled to start. Would you let him start?
I probably would, but I would also have it's all hands on deck on that day.
What about you, Larry?
I agree.
You still would start Kershaw?
I would
see if Fernando Valenzuela has anything left because he might. I don't trust him
Can
anymore.
He still throw the screwball?
I think he'll be better at Dodger Stadium if he pitches in one of these games because he'll have a feel for the curveball. It's very cold. If anyone that's tried to throw a baseball in cold weather knows that you got to have a feel for the pitch, and the cold takes that feel away. So he'll be a little bit better, but I don't think that's enough anymore.
Yeah.
Well, some historical perspective, in 65 when the Dodgers lost the first two games in Minnesota, they came back here and they swept the Twins and went back and eventually won that series in 7. And in 81, they lost the first two games of the series against the Yankees, came back here and swept three remarkable games.
And they're all really low-scoring games.
They were, the second one was
the Minnesota series?
The Minnesota, no, the Dodgers whacked them.
Really?
Yeah, 4-0, 7-2, and 7-0, I think, were the scores in those games. I know. I'm a little into this stuff.
It's all off the top of his head, folks.
So, but what in those two series, what happened is that game 3, a pitcher had to step up and win that ball game. And in 1965, of all pitchers, after Koufax and Drysdale couldn't do it, it was Claude Osteen who shut out the Twins. And in 81, it was a kind of shaky Fernando, but he hung in there, and they ended up winning that ball game. So whoever pitches tomorrow, which is going to be Walker Buehler, that guy's got to really pitch well and win that game, or else forget it.
Yeah, and so what are your feelings about Buehler coming off his most recent outings in the playoffs?
Dodgers aren't going to get swept at home. That's not going to happen. They're going to at least win one of these games at home. It probably is going to be tomorrow. I that's the one guy outside of Rue that I have most confidence in. Walker Buehler is a rookie. He maybe doesn't realize how big the moment is, which I think is a good thing for this team. They need someone to just go out there and fire, and I think he's going to do a great job. But as far as getting back to Boston, it's as confident as I was that the series one way or another would be back in Boston next week, I don't know anymore.
Yeah, and you think if the Dodgers win two of the three, goes back to Boston, what do you think are the odds that the Dodgers could win both games in Boston?
No, that's it. I'd love to say yes, and I'd love to be a cheerleader and hope and snap the 30-year World Series drought, but I have to be realistic, too.
To me, that seems like it would be a tougher place to play than even Yankee Stadium for a visiting team because of the way that stadium is built. You were talking last time we spoke, Nick, about this. The fans are absolutely on top of you.
Yeah. Well, we talked to Reggie Smith the other day, who played for both teams and both the Dodgers and the Red Sox in the World Series.
He's not going to be intimidated by anything.
No. And he was a switch hitter. And so I asked him, when you go into Fenway and you look at that green monster, do you start thinking, wow, I can hit that thing? And he says, if you do that, you're going to mess up your swing and you're not going to hit anything. And he's right about that. So you have to stay with the same approach that really the best approach the Dodgers could take is the one that we all liked, which was game five against Milwaukee, where they just peppered away and won that ball game going away with base hits and base hits and base hits. I don't think they hit a home run in that ballgame.
Some modifications of their swing.
There are National League rules for the next three games, so the pitcher has to hit. So that's the one advantage the Dodgers have, too.
And that may be a big advantage, too.
All right. We're talking with a triple play. A. Martinez of Take Two, Nick Roman, All Things Considered, Larry Mantle with you. You can share your comments about the Dodgers Red Sox World Series at 866-893-KPECC or on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Tony writes on the page, when Roger Craig was managing the Giants, I always said there was no one else I'd choose to coach a 162-game season, but he was the last person I'd pick if I needed to win one game. Sounds like the Dodgers have the same problem.
Yeah, and here's the thing, too. So let's just say Walker Buehler does not have a great start tomorrow. I mean, who do you call? I mean, who would you have confidence out of that bullpen to call in early tomorrow night if you need a few innings of long relief?
Well, Arias has stuff in the tank, right?
Yeah,
even though he pitched, he could. So, yeah.
I think it would probably be him because he's looked really good. And I know the season's not over. The series isn't over. But watching him in these, in the last couple of weeks makes me think, boy, next year is going to be really nice when he's a starter all the time.
Yeah. Do you still hold to your position that you don't think Kershaw's going to opt out of his contract?
No, that's $70 million. That's just all he has to do is do nothing to get $70 million. That's like winning a lottery ticket.
Yeah. There are just so many doubts. And the health thing, I think, is a big concern for teams. And then length of contract. And then who's going to give that money to him? There's only a handful of teams that would do it. The Giants might have that money. The Phillies might. The Yankees obviously always do. The Cubs. But are those attractive places for him? I don't know.
But you know what would bug me? If, say, he opts out and he's a free agent and the Dodgers get in a bidding war to bring him back.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be, and maybe he'll hope that's the case. Giants and the Dodgers, because isn't Bumgarner a free agent?
No, not yet.
Does he have one more year?
Yeah. Not yet.
He's still going very cost controlled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Patrick
okay.
Corbin with Arizona is the one who looks like the prime pitcher who's going to be a free agent.
All right. So that, of course, what's there on the market may also have some determination on what Kershaw does. All right, gentlemen, you both sound a little like I feel sort of shaky about the Dodgers' prospects here.
Well, that's me normally, though. I'm a pessimist.
If they win tomorrow, then I'm back to being wildly and unrealistically optimistic. You know, that goes right back.
All right. And I've already upset people by even mentioning a bidding war for Kershaw with the Giants. Giants. The idea of seeing him in a Giants uniform. Didn't Oral Hershiser end his career in a Giants uniform?
Oh, yeah, he did.
Which is still tough to forget.
Well, no, he came back to the Dodgers. He wasn't very good, but he did come back to the Dodgers.
All right, yeah, Oral will always be a Dodger to me. All right, gentlemen, thanks so much. It's the Triple Play. Nick Roman, A. Martinez, I'm Larry Mantle. We have much more to come on Air Talk, including our election coverage. We'll talk with Javier Becerra, who's the state attorney general in California. We talked with his challenger yesterday. Much more to come.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I'm still marveling at Nick Roman's incredible recall of Dodgers scores from the 1965 World Series. He does this all the time. Wow. Well, we know Nick's not going to get Alzheimer's. Having that kind of recall, that's remarkable. Nick Roman, A. Martinez joining me last hour as part of the Triple Play, looking at the Dodgers' diminished World Series chances here, down 2-0 in the best of 7 series. Joining us is Angelino Javier Becerra, California Attorney General. He's joining us from the studios of fellow NPR member station KQED San Francisco. Thank you very much, Mr. Becerra, for joining us.
Larry, good to be with you.
So let's start, first of all, yesterday we talked with your opponent in this race, the Republican Stephen Bailey, and he had a number of critiques that he mentioned. One of them is that as the current state attorney general, you've not done enough to remove from the possession of people not legally entitled to have them guns that are in their possession. He said there are 10,000 firearms in the state that are held by individuals that your office has the jurisdiction to remove. Can you respond to that, please?
He should get his statistics right. We have actually reduced the number of individuals who are in possession of these weapons that shouldn't have them. And it's a function of how much personnel you have. We have some small teams that go around. You can't do this by with one law enforcement officer at a time. You take teams to go out there and try to repossess these weapons from people who've lost the permission to hold them. And over the last 5 years, some 18,000 of these weapons have been removed from the hands of people who are either felons or dangerous individuals. We just recently did another action where we took weapons away in L.A. County from some, I believe it was 60 or so individuals, and we're going to continue to do that. And in the last year, I've gone to the legislature at least twice, hoping that I can get more resources to expand the teams so we can cover all of California well. But we're working on it, and we're doing a good job. And perhaps the best thing I can say, Larry, is that in all those efforts to remove the tens of thousands of weapons over these last several years, there's not been one incident where one of our agents or any individual in the community has been harmed.
So what can you do about the Dodgers right now? seriously, do you have a count of how many weapons you think are still in the custody of people not legally entitled to own them?
And it's a tough one because when we go in to – and remember, we're cross-checking registration. So somebody has registered 1, 2, 3, 4 weapons, and all of a sudden they commit a crime or they are involved in a domestic violence dispute, and now there's a restraining order upon them. Now we have the right to go in and confiscate those weapons. We go in typically, and instead of finding the 2, 3, or 4 weapons that individual has registered, oftentimes we'll find 10, 15, 20. In some cases, more than 100. And we'll find more than just the weapon that you might think of, the firearm, the gun. We've found everything from machine guns to rocket launchers. And so it's one of those things where you're never quite sure what you'll find, and you have to be very cautious because you're talking about repossessing weapons that people have intentionally decided not to return. And so it's not one of those things that you get up in the morning and say, hey, let's go get these weapons today.
We're talking with Javier Becerra, California Attorney General, the Democratic incumbent in the office. He's being challenged by Republican Stephen Bailey. And if you missed that interview, you can find it on our AirTalk page from yesterday at kpecc.org. One of the other critiques that he issued was that this should really be, despite the fact that there is a partisan label on the candidate, should be conducted as a nonpartisan office. And he said, you're 40 plus some lawsuits that have been filed against the Trump administration and statements against the president, that essentially you have made this a highly partisan position. Your response to that?
If any president wants to attack the state of California's right to enforce its own laws, I will challenge that president regardless of his or her party. If there is a federal government that is trying to subvert the rights of a state to protect its people, provide for the general welfare in ways that the Constitution never expected, I will challenge the federal government, whoever is in charge from whatever party. The reason we have had to sue the Trump administration so many times, now over 40 times, is because they continue to try to attack the things that have allowed California to move forward. If Mr. Bailey doesn't like that, then he's got the right as a citizen to speak up. But I would hope that he would not abandon the efforts that we've undertaken to recoup the tens of millions of dollars that the federal government is trying to withhold from our law enforcement agencies, because they want us to do their bidding and their job when it comes to federal immigration deportation. That's not our job. That's the federal government's job. And we allow them to do it under the law, but we don't have to do it for them. And that's why recently a federal court decided that the Trump administration owes California $29 million for unlawfully withholding funds from our law enforcement.
Now, he claims that instead of filing lawsuits, that your office could negotiate, could have conversations with federal officials, and that there are other ways of pushing back aside from filing lawsuits. Respond, please.
That's what we've done. And because this administration has been unwilling to listen, we do what we have to do. We tried to talk to the administration, for example, on the clean car standards that we have nationwide that make sure that we continue to have vehicles that are manufactured, that continue to produce cleaner burning engines. And this administration decided to back away from its own national standards. We try to talk them out of it because climate change is an existential issue for everyone, and they chose not to. And so we have only one recourse left at this stage when they decide they want to violate their own laws and they want to violate their own agreements. And so we have, on every occasion where we can, try to explain to them what they're doing wrong and what they're doing against the law before we file a suit. Most of the time, we have to by law do that because there's a comment period that's provided for whenever the federal government tries to change its rules. And we've always participated in the comment periods. Unfortunately, this administration doesn't do a lot of listening. And so we have we do what we have to do, which is at the end of the day, if the Trump administration won't listen, we'll take them to court.
We're talking with Democratic Attorney General for California, Javier Becerra, a former congressman from the Los Angeles area. And you can ask questions of him on the AirTalk page. You can also call and ask questions through our call screeners at 866-893-KPECC. What role do you see for the state attorney general when it comes to the homelessness crisis that's affecting California's major cities, even some of the smaller communities in the state? Is there more that your office can do to assist local jurisdictions in dealing with the problem?
We can try to be a resource and be one of the partners in trying to make this work statewide. We don't have direct jurisdiction over those issues. Most of those issues are going to be handled at the local level. And to the degree that the state gets involved, it will be done through the legislature and the governor. But certainly my office, we're prepared to try to be as helpful as we can in coordinating with local law enforcement and making sure that what is done legally. But we don't have the first say on the issue of homelessness. But having been a member of Congress who has weighed in on this issue for decades, and having represented parts of L.A. that have Skid Row. I've been very involved, and I don't intend, simply because I've now gone from being a policymaker to an enforcer, to stop my efforts on the policy side to make things better. I think most people now agree that when it comes to homelessness, the best approach is to make sure that you get someone permanently housed, so then you can treat all the other issues that might be involved in creating the homelessness situation for that individual, whether it's a mental issue, a healthcare issue, a job training issue. But if you can't give people the stability of a permanent home, it makes it difficult to tackle all the other issues.
You've faced some criticism from Republicans over the titles of ballot propositions. And explain, if you would, how you determine that a title is not just legal, but appropriately describes what the initiative is trying to do.
We have a team at the Department of Justice that has been doing this for years, where they look over the entire initiative, the actual language of the initiative, not what the proponents or opponents say about it, now how they characterize it, but the actual text of the initiative. Based on the text and what the text actually calls for, my team, my legal team then that works on these, will put together drafts of the initiative language, the title and summary. The parameters that we have to work under are pretty stiff. We get 100 total words to describe an initiative, both in the title and in the summary. So we have to figure out a way to crunch everything into 100 words and still be descriptive of an initiative which may be tens and hundreds of pages long. And so we do the best we can by distilling the most important purpose of the initiative. And so that's how we come up with the language. So someone may say to you, it's the apple pie and motherhood initiative to give everyone access to a home. We can't describe it that way. We have to describe exactly what it does. And so oftentimes proponents or even opponents of an initiative aren't happy with the language because they'd rather describe it the way they like. Unfortunately, we have to base it, our title and our summary in 100 words, on what the initiative actually says.
Have you ever, because of that criticism early on, gone back and the Department of Justice modified anything because, that's a valid point, we hadn't thought of it, or have they always stayed the same once the department has released the language?
We have adjusted on occasion, and typically it's because we're persuaded that the change of a word or a phrase might give a better description of the actual language of the initiative. But I will tell you that every initiative goes through a vetting process. They all get scrubbed, not just by me or my team. They get scrubbed by the courts. And no initiative gets on the ballot, or no title and summary of initiative gets on the ballot for voters to look at, unless it's been scrubbed by everyone, including the courts. And those who complain about the language have recourse. They can go to court, as many have, and the ultimate language that you see in the title and summary on those ballot pamphlets is based on a court having decided what the language will be, not just me as the Attorney General. So every initiative that's on to this year's ballot has gone through that scrubbing process. And so anyone who's complaining had a chance or had their day in court, and the language that you see on these ballot initiatives, on the title and summary, is what even a court has said is appropriate.
We're talking with Javier Becerra, California Attorney General, just finishing out his first term in office, running for re-election, facing the challenge from Republican Stephen Bailey, who was a sitting judge in Northern California before his retirement. Javier Becerra was also a Democratic member of the House of Representatives from Los Angeles for a number of years before first being appointed to the Attorney General's office and then winning that position. We're talking with him about his candidacy, and if you have questions, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Monkey writes on the page, Attorney General Becerra, how do you plan on minimizing, investigating, and obtaining justice for those wrongly convicted? How do you change the culture in the judicial system and penalize prosecutors and judges who deviate from the law? He's talking about wrongful convictions. Mr. Becerra?
And that's an excellent question, because we're always striving to figure out how we can be part of that move towards real justice at the California Department of Justice. Let me give you one quick example. Bail reform. For the longest time, whenever we've talked about bail, we always think of it in terms of money. So someone is accused of a crime, is arrested and arraigned. A judge will then say your trial will be set for 6 months from now or et cetera in the future. And in order for you to be released from detention, from jail, you must pay X amount of bail, $300,000 bail. For a lot of folks, even if they are innocent, paying $300,000 in bail to be released until the time of trial is impossible. And so you are innocent until you're proven guilty. But in this country, because of money bail, you could be held in prison even though you're innocent because you don't have the money. And so there's a movement underway, and California is part of that, to remove the system of detention before trial and any guilty verdict towards things that would detain you based on your danger to the public or danger of you fleeing the state or the country before your trial, not based on how much money you have. You could be filthy rich and very dangerous to the public, but you can bail yourself out, and that's not fair to the person who's dirt poor, totally innocent, but has to serve time in jail because he or she can't bail himself out.
That bill's now been signed into law, right?
That's now in law. That's now in law, and it will start to take effect in about the next year or so. There is an initiative that's trying to work its way through to the ballot that would undo that reform before it has a chance to take place. And I hope that Californians move forward because it is unfair to base your detention on the money, the dollars in your pocket, not your danger to the public.
All right. I want to thank you very much. State Attorney General Javier Becerra, appreciate your joining us today on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Democrat Javier Becerra running for re-election, seeking a second full term. He's former member of the House of Representatives from Los Angeles. Stephen Bailey is the Republican, retired El Dorado County Superior Court judge. And again, if you missed our interview with Mr. Bailey yesterday, you can find it on our Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we stay in an election frame of mind. We'll debate Proposition 4, a $1.5 billion a ballot measure. It's yet another one of the bond measures, four of them on the California ballot. This is money for children's hospitals. We'll talk about that coming up in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and a reminder, this is your one-stop place for election information. KPCC in LA has all that you need. Ballot proposition, candidates, interviews. You'll find our whole voter game plan at elections.laist. That's LAIST.com, elections.laist.com for all the information. And of course, our voter game plan will keep you up to date on everything. You can find all of our Air Talk interviews and all of our debates on the ballot measures. Also want to remind you, coming up on this weekend, I'll get you the date and time for our voter cram session. Airs this weekend. We'll give you the details on that in case you missed it the first time around. Right now, we turn our attention to Proposition 4 on your California ballot. It authorizes $1.5 billion in bonds to be repaid from the state's general fund. The money would go for construction, expansion, renovation, and equipping of qualifying children's hospitals in California. 72% of the funds would go to qualified private nonprofit hospitals that provide comprehensive services to children eligible for governmental programs. 18% of funds would go to University of California General Acute Care Children's Hospitals, and 10% go to public and private nonprofit hospitals that provide services to children eligible for the California Children's Services Program. So the cost to the state to repay the bonds would average $80 million a year over the next 35 years. With us to speak in favor of Proposition 4, the chair of the California Children's Hospital Association, the official sponsor of Yes on 4, and Louise Kunz. Thank you very much, Ms. Kunz, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So why is it the children's hospitals need the bond measure to fund these projects?
Well, the reason is twofold, really. First, we're seeing an increase in the number of children seeking services at our hospitals. It's because pediatric specialty care is becoming much more regionalized. And that's actually for a couple of reasons. It's really a sign of success in a lot of ways. It reflects increased survival for children that used to not survive complex medical conditions like extreme prematurity. Children with cystic fibrosis, for example, are living now. Average age life expectancy is now 40. So what we're seeing is children are able to survive into adulthood with conditions that used to be fatal, and that's driving some increased demand for our services. Also, it's very difficult for community hospitals to maintain efficiently that sort of level of expertise that you would need to treat some of these more complex conditions. That's another thing kind of driving the increased demand for our regionalized services. So that's number one. The second thing is that the state has enacted new seismic safety standards for hospitals. And the intention is to make sure that hospitals can continue not only to stand after a major earthquake, but also to continue to see patients after an earthquake.
Some of those hospitals have, in fact, closed just because the cost of retrofitting was so great. There was no way to amortize that if they were already on shaky ground in the market.
Right, exactly. We saw that recently in Long Beach. So CHLA, for example, if you consider that hospital, they just invested in a new patient tower. It cost about $640 million to build. And that hospital, I'm told by CHLA officials, is probably one of the safest buildings to be in an earthquake. But they still have a second tower with about 55 beds in it that is not compliant yet with that new seismic standard. And so part of the purpose of the bond is to make sure that all of our buildings, we have about 28% of our beds or 818 beds across the state that are not yet fully seismically compliant. So the other part of the bond is to make sure that we are completely seismically compliant and we can continue to operate in the event of a major earthquake.
And why would the state be involved in issuing these bonds for private nonprofit hospitals as opposed to the hospitals themselves issuing bonds and repaying over time for these investments?
Sure. Well, the short answer is that most of the patients that we see in our hospitals are actually on public programs. And if those public programs actually paid their fair share for the cost of the services, we wouldn't need to come to voters. But every year, we actually, out of our own funds, our hospitals spend $30 to $50 million of their own money investing in infrastructure upgrades. Our hospitals have about $2.5 billion in bonds that they've issued themselves to help finance upgrades. But Medi-Cal doesn't pay even for its costs for services, let alone for the cost for infrastructure. So really what we're talking about is a shortfall in the Medi-Cal reimbursement rate that doesn't cover services per se. So we can't set aside funds from those for infrastructure investments. And two-thirds of the patients that we see in our hospitals are covered by Medi-Cal.
We're talking with Anne Louise Kunz, chair of the California Children's Hospital Association. If you have questions about Proposition 4, $1.5 billion bond measure with the money going to children's hospitals in the state, you can ask it by calling 866-893-KPCC. You can also post your question on our AirTalk page for the segment at kpcc.org. Also with us, the legislative director from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, David Wolf. Mr. Wolf, thank you for joining us.
Larry, hey, it's good to be back on the air again with you and your listeners.
So I understand Howard Jarvis has not taken a position on Proposition 4. I'm sure you're not against children's hospitals. But I did want to ask you what, if any, financial concerns that you have about the $1.5 billion through a bond.
Sure, Larry. Now, and as you mentioned, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association doesn't have a position. So I think concerns here is a good word to use. And I would like to just list three concerns really quickly that we have with the measure. And the first, as you mentioned, is debt load. You know, it's important to consider that this is a $2.9 billion bond with interest that's going to have to be paid off over the next 35 years. That's about $80 million a year. Now, vis-a-vis the affordable housing bond and the water bond and some of the other bonds on the ballot, that's not huge. But when you look at that in total, you're looking at about $14 billion worth of bonds on the November ballot. That's going to cost billions of dollars of general fund revenue to pay off each and every year once those bonds are sold. And I think all those things need to be looked at in totality. So,
all right. And in terms of other ways for the hospitals to raise this money, we just heard from Ms. Coons, the reason that they're asking the state voters to do this is because the reimbursements that come from the state program aren't really sufficient for these kinds of capital investments. You have a thought on that?
Sure, Larry. I mean, this is not an awful bond, which I think is why Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association doesn't have a position on it. But there are things within the bond language that I think should concern all California taxpayers in terms of, you know, if you go ahead and say yes to this bond, are you getting the best bang for your buck? As you mentioned in your opening, 70% of the money received, you know, from this bond goes to private hospitals, which do fundraise and fundraise fairly well. Six of the eight private nonprofit hospitals, the biggest ones, reported annual profits ranging from $18 million to $176 million. And this bond would provide each hospital $135 million regardless of profit or loss. So, again, hospital bond completely bad? No. But, again, it's a question of equity. Should taxpayers be funding private hospitals? And is it appropriate that even the most well-funded hospitals are getting $135 million each?
We're talking with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association Legislative Director, David Wolf. And again, the Jarvis Association is not taking an official position on Prop 4, but David Wolf sharing some of his concerns about the bond measure, using it this way for the funding for capital projects at children's hospitals. And Louise Coons, also with us from that California Children's Hospital Association, which she chairs. So I did want to ask you about these because, you know, when we think of children's hospitals here in Southern California, we think of very robust institutions, very high stature, very large fundraising capacity, very dedicated donors with large capacity to give. Again, what would happen if this, let's say this didn't pass, wouldn't those hospitals find other ways to raise the money to do the earthquake retrofits and to be able to handle the larger capacity patient load?
Well, let me give you an example of the kinds of trade-offs that are involved here. So, and it is very true that our hospitals do fundraise. They fundraise all the time. When I was at CHLA recently, Paul Viviano, who is actually the chair of our association, I'm the president and CEO of the association, he was mentioning that they have 28 ambulances and I think two helicopters that help provide, you know, that sort of emergency support from the community to the hospital that's completely funded through an endowment from a donor. So those sorts of investments are going on all the time. But at the same time, we have operationally large programs that serve very difficult to treat populations that are predominantly covered by public programs like Medi-Cal. And an example there would be, you know, Children's Hospital Oakland operates one of two sickle cell centers in the state. They cover about 700, they see about 700 kids a year. Sickle cell disease is a very complicated disease. Very few hematologists are really trained to treat that disease state. Since 2/3 of the patient population is on Medi-Cal, the cost to operate that sickle cell center at Oakland loses $3.5 million every year just for those patients. So when we go to fundraise, we're also going to fundraise to basically just cover the cost of our operations.
To backfill that gap.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder, though, and I'm sort of putting you on the spot, have we passed other bond measures like this for private nonprofit general hospitals to do what is being asked here for the children's hospitals?
I believe that there have been district hospitals at the local level that have passed bonds in the past, yes.
So this be like county by county sort of a thing that are passed? Because I'm just wondering, why would it be different for a children's hospital where there's certain parts of the state where presumably the majority of care, if not to indigent population, would be to those that are on some form of public health care, where there would be a gap that would have to be filled and where it would be difficult to come up with funds for capital investments. So I was wondering, what's different about the kids' hospitals than general?
Well, actually, one of the biggest differences between children's hospitals and community hospitals is just the percentage on Medi-Cal. The average community hospital sees more Medicare patients, and Medicare is a more balanced payer. They pay closer to what the cost of delivering the services.
No Medicare patients at children's hospitals.
No Medicare patients at children's hospitals. And Medi-Cal in the state of California is ranks 48th in out of 50 states in how low the reimbursement to providers is. And that's part of the struggle for us is just we want to be there for all families, regardless of ability to pay or family income. And in order to do that, we need a little bit of help to cross the bridge for this infrastructure gap that we're facing.
All right. I need to wrap up. David Wolf, Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association, just a quick final word.
Yeah, Laurie, I would just say this is not the first bite at the apple for these children's hospitals. There have been two bonds that have been approved, $750 million in 2004 and $980 million in 2008. It might be different if this was the first bond in 20 years that benefited children's hospitals, but it's not. And I think, again, for the reasons I mentioned, taxpayers need to be on the alert on this one.
I want to thank you both so much. That's David Wolf, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers, and Louise Kunz, who is the president and CEO of the California Children's Hospital Association, which is sponsoring Proposition 4's Yes campaign. Once again, you have a chance to vote on this November 6th California ballot, $1.5 billion bond measure investing in children's hospitals in the state. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. Such pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I have a terrific little place near where I live that my wife or I will pop into sometimes and pick up some food to go, maybe some soup or a sandwich or salad, something like that. Just very convenient. But like many establishments these days, they have an iPad that they flip around for you to use your finger to sign off on your credit card purchase, and up pops a page which has a suggested tip. Now, there's no table service, of course. You're picking up your food to go just right there at the counter. But there's a suggested tip, 10, 15, 20%. My question for you is, does that make you feel pressured to leave a tip when you wouldn't otherwise, or historically when you wouldn't necessarily tip when you pick up items to go? You, of course, see this at coffee shops as well, and more food establishments using the point of sale, tablet, iPad or the like, as a way for you not just to pay for your purchase, but for you to tip for it as well. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is personal finance columnist, multi-time Air Talk guest, Liz Weston. She writes for Nerd Wallet and is a certified financial planner. Liz, good to have you with us again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
So you have a sense of how widespread these point-of-sale tablets are becoming?
They're really becoming a big deal. I mean, I'm finding them just about anywhere. Food trucks, bakeries, the little restaurant that you talked about. We've got one of those in our neighborhood as well. And it's kind of startling. You've got two things colliding here that tend to frustrate people. One is technology, and the other is tipping. And when you have them shoved together like that, it's, you know, no wonder that people are getting a little anxious about, you know, when do I tip? Am I doing it right? Or feeling put upon? Why are you asking me for a tip when you didn't in the past?
Yeah, there's a sandwich place close to where we work here in Pasadena. They have a little tip jar, and I'll, you know, throw a buck or two in when I pick up my sandwich at the counter. But I wouldn't typically tip, you know, 15 or 20% for counter service. And the fact that that's sitting there as an option on the tablet, at least I do feel a bit of peer pressure in that. How about you?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's there, actually. I mean, they do want to make it more convenient for you because, you know, if you use the Starbucks app, for example, for a while there was no option to give a tip and it was a little awkward. Okay, do I dig cash out of my pocket now? So there is part of that. They're trying to make the transaction easier. But my editor went in for a haircut, and when they presented the square pad to him, the minimum suggested tip was 25%.
Wow, the minimum?
Yeah, that was the minimum. Now, you could change it if you could take a minute to look and see all your options, but, you know, you're not usually in that headspace when you're confronted with new technology. You know, our brains tend to sort of scramble about what to do next, so you just, you know, pick the easiest thing, which, you know, they're hoping is that 25% tip. So it just requires us to be a little more thoughtful in dealing with this new technology. And we will get used to it, and we'll figure out how to do it like we do everything else.
I welcome your calls. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. And if you're someone who works the counter in an establishment that uses one of these pad point-of-sale ways for the customer to complete the purchase, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. I would bet the tips have gone up considerably since you've gone to this. 866-893-KPECC. Anne in Santa Barbara says it's so awkward because you wonder how it'll affect your food. I'm not sure what to do. I wonder if it'll affect how they treat me the next time I come in. That's Anne in Santa Barbara. 866-893-KPECC. EGW writes on the AirTalk page, the real story here is why people are so scared. You know, speaking to why we sort of feel that peer pressure. But, you know, we are social creatures. It's not surprising that when we see a suggested tip on a tablet in front of us, that we're experiencing that sort of intellectual tension between what I think is fair for the comparatively small amount of labor that goes into the person working in the counter, who's dealing in volume typically, versus tableside service, where the person is dealing with a much, you know, smaller number of people, and the larger tip there is essential because it's a smaller number of customer interactions. But the person working at the counter, even if they're getting a buck or two tip, you know, they're doing okay typically if most people are tipping because of volume at a high volume place. That's a lot of money going into the jar. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Maureen, in Echo Park, what do you think about these suggested tips on the pads?
I'm so glad you brought this up because I hate it. I absolutely hate it, and I feel totally pressured to do it. And I get so mad that they start at 15% because I go to another coffee shop that's lovely, and they start at 5%. Like, you have the option to do 5%, which I get the 5%. Like, that's fine with me, and I always do it. But when they start at 15, I think it's totally, I think it's robbery. I'm like, why are you doing it? It's so manipulative.
Well, and then what's the appropriate tip to give the server who's tableside? Because if you're giving someone who's providing the counter service dealing in volume 15%,
yeah,
then we should be giving waiters and waitresses, what, 40% or 50%? Yeah.
I think those things should be down to 5% at the counter, and then you can tip your 15 or your 20 if you feel that way at the table service. But it's robbery that they're handing you a bag and you're tipping them 15%.
Maureen, I appreciate your call. I think you speak for many. So, Liz, does it feel to you out of balance that if you're tipping the person at the counter 15 or 20%, then the table side server should be getting 40 or 50?
Well, you know, it's been a long time since I waited tables. But, you know, when I worked either as a waitress or behind the counter, I never expected as much when I was behind the counter. In fact, I don't even remember if tipping was common. I mean, we're talking about a long time ago. So I would love to hear from some servers how
yeah.
they feel about it these days.
Because, I would.
You know, I'm a little bit out of touch with this.
Yeah, that would be great. Liz Weston, certified financial planner and writer on financial issues with us. If you work in the service industry at the counter and you're using one of these point-of-sale devices, typically an iPad for the customer to sign off on the credit card bill and to perhaps press the button for the automatic tip at a specific percentage, let us know how that's working out. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jason in Brea says, well, I think restaurant employees make less than minimum wage and make it up in tips, but counter employees make minimum wage. Isn't that right? Well, actually, under California law now, everyone has to make the minimum wage. Tips are on top of that. Liz, that's my understanding, at least.
Oh, I haven't kept up with it, but I do know that, you know, the federal minimum wage was set up so that it was well below the normal minimum wage because it was assumed that people would be tipping. I mean, the whole system is a little bit wonky and uncomfortable to begin with. It makes you want to go back to France, you know, or England, where tipping is not the thing that it is here. It's sort of a, you know, a casual thing. You might leave a euro or two on the table. You're not providing somebody's bread and butter, which is a very awkward system. And so understandably, people aren't happy with it. But that's the system that we've got. We got to deal with it.
All right. Mark in Bellflower, I understand you own a coffee shop. So how do you deal with this?
I do. We're actually expanding a second location to Bellflower, and our main one is in Artesia. But
congratulations. Glad it's going well.
Thank you. Thank you. It's going well. So one of the callers' concern was, is the barista going to, or is the server or the barista going to change the service or the product that they're putting out? And I would say no, absolutely not, because cafes and restaurants are so busy. When they turn that iPad around and the customer chooses the 10, 15, 20% or whatever, the barista has no way of knowing what they chose. They're already working on the drink. And they're going to, you know, if an establishment hires well, you're going to have baristas that are putting out good drinks no matter what. My second comment would be a lot of times the labor is our most expensive expense, or it's our largest expense. So a lot of times people start out at minimum wage, and those tips, even if it's a dollar on a drink, makes a big difference on their paycheck to help them survive in this economy and cost of living area.
Have you gotten any pushback from your customers? Sounds like you used this point of sale process. Have you gotten any pushback from them when you introduced it?
No, not at all. And we train the baristas not to stand there and hover over the iPad when people are making their choice. We want it to be as low pressure as possible.
And did you use a tip jar prior to using this?
We have, yes. And we have an actual cash tip jar there, too, which people, if they pay with cash, they can, you know, throw a dollar in or some quarters or whatever their change. They'll put that in there, too.
All right. Very good. I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts as someone who owns one and opening up a second location. Mark has places on Artesia and Bellflower. I'd like to hear from you if you work in a food or beverage service place where at counter service you use a pad with a suggested tip percentage. What have customers told you about that? How has it changed the amount of tips that you've collected as well? I should have, Mark, are you still there?
I'm here.
Yeah, Mark, how much has tips gone up since you went to this?
Oh, boy, I don't know as a percentage, but, you know, I would guess probably 20 to 50% increase.
Wow. I'm not surprised. All right, Mark, thanks for that. We'll continue back with your calls and more input on this in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about the growing trends of counter service restaurants, beverage places, coffee shops, using iPads that they flip around for you to sign with your fingertip on your credit card purchase, and that typically pops up as part of the process a suggested tip percentage. And asking what you think about that. Again, you know, traditionally, wasn't that long ago, that there wasn't even a tip jar for counter service places. Just assumed, you know, that this is not a tipped service. Then we started seeing tip jars typically at these locations. And now the tip jar, if it's gone, has evolved or is now alongside the pad formatted way for you to tip. And my question is, for counter service, do you think that's right? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. VR in Long Beach, good to have you with us. You're a restaurant owner?
Yes, sir.
So what do you do for counter service?
I have a Square register, and I have a small sign that says you are not obligated to tip, just your smile is tip enough.
How friendly. That's nice. And how have customers responded, VR?
Phenomenal. In the past, my tip used to be equivalent to my sales tax that I would collect on a day. Today, my tip is about 300% higher than what the tips I used to get before.
So and do we got a really small establishment, a mom and pop store inside a medical building called Apu's Cafe.
Apu's Cafe. All right. And you, so you feel as though in making it clear to your customers that you don't need to tip, smile is enough, you think that maybe that makes people give more?
Yeah, they do, because they really enjoy the food. You know, it takes away the pressure. When the sign is right there, or if I am at the counter telling my customers, hey, they look and say, where's your tip jar? And I say, oh, you know, a tip is not necessary. Just the smile on your face is all that I look for. And they smile and they drop a $10 or a $20.
Wow.
And walk away for my one employee inside the restaurant. I only have one employee and myself, and we run a really small cafe, and we are in the top 100 best restaurants in the United States 2 years in a row.
Wait, top 100 restaurants inside a medical building? VR, I'm gonna have to check up on this. All right.
Me up on Yelp. It's a Apu's Cafe, man. It's there.
Okay, all right, VR. I appreciate it. We'll have to check that out. But I think the point about taking the pressure off of customers kind of makes sense, because then it's more in the spirit of giving when you actually tip. I'm curious for other restaurant owners what you do. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Liz Weston, what do you think about that approach of you know, taking the pressure off the customer?
Oh, my gosh, I love that. And we should point out that with the square tablet, when they're turning it towards you, you actually do have the opportunity to change it. You can either say no tip typically or custom tip amount. So sometimes when I walk into establishment, I try to, you know, I normally leave a buck or two for counter service or for a coffee or whatever. I just think about that when I'm walking through the door, so that when I'm confronted with that tablet, it's not a total surprise and I can figure out what I want. But you can customize the tip amount. It is up to you. And typically it's not an obligation unless obviously it's table service.
All right. Let's take another call. This comes from Brian in Venice. Hi, Brian. What do you think about this trend of the point of purchase tablets?
Hi, Larry. I'm actually a big fan of it. I was a bartender and for 10 years out here in Santa Monica and Venice area. And I mean, I'd take off a bottle cap from a beer and, you know, customers would leave me a dollar or two just for doing that. And then when I'm in a coffee shop and they're steaming milk and making this nice latte for me, I mean, I felt like they're doing a lot more work and a lot of people aren't even leaving tips. So I love this easiness. Accessibility to leave a tip to the barista.
Brian's great point you make. There is a lot of labor involved, particularly in something like, you know, the exotic coffee and tea-based drinks that you find. Thanks so much, Brian. 866-893-KPCC. Chris in Highland Park, your thoughts on these point-of-purchase tablets and suggested tips.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Good.
I'd like to touch on two points here. Earlier, you guys were discussing 15% at a counter service establishment versus 15 or 20%, or you were saying maybe do we tip 40% at a restaurant? But my point is that 20 or 15% at a table at a counter service establishment like a coffee shop is going to be a dollar, you know, from a $5 bill, whereas at a restaurant, you know, a bill could be $100, $50, so 20% of that is going to be a big difference.
Yeah, if you're just buying a latte, you're absolutely right. But many of the places that use this are full food establishments. So if you're picking up dinner on your way home or something, you're going to be paying, you know, similar to what you'd be paying at a sit-down restaurant. So in a case like that, do you tip the same for someone assembling your food you're taking to go, your sandwiches, salads, or what have you, putting that in the bag for you? Do you tip that person at the same level that you do someone who's a server tableside bringing you the same meal?
Well, I would say that's up to the person, and you definitely have the option, like the previous woman said, where you can leave no tip or a custom tip. My other point is that most of the businesses that employees work at, the counter service style places like we're talking about, are low wage workers who rely on those tips to supplement their income.
Very good point.
Without the tips at the counter, they're not going to be walking away with what they're hoping to at the end of the week.
Chris, I really appreciate it. Excellent point that you raise. Rick in Long Beach says, I think this is part of a growing trend of passive aggressiveness where it's on the customer to decline something. We have to say no. It's uncomfortable. That's Rick in Long Beach. I want to thank Liz Weston, personal finance columnist and certified financial planner. Liz can be read in NerdWallet. Liz, thanks so much as always. Appreciate your joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Fresh Air. Terry Gross is next. Have a great afternoon.